Last class, we finished up talking about habituation. So we got into habituation and sensitization, simplest forms of learning. We said that what happens with habituation is due to repeated presentations of a stimulus, you get a gradual reduction and possibly complete cessation of a reflexive response. Sensitization is the opposite. Due to the presentation of a stimulus, the intensity of the reflexive response actually increases. So, here's an example of what you could do with sensitizing a rat. So we can start with, take a rat, a sprag dolly, your common white laboratory rat, and just touch it gently on the back. Give it a light touch. Probably not much is going to happen. You can measure the degree of startlement. There's these little things called, I kid you not, this is actually what they're called. It's a piece of equipment. It's called a jiggle platform. So you put the rat on the jiggle platform, and if the rat moves, it makes the platform jiggle, and there's little sensors there that measure how much jiggling occurs. All right, fair enough. So we put the rat on the platform, touch it gently on the back, and maybe it jiggles a little bit, but probably not too much. We can do this a few times to get a nice baseline measure. All right, so then what we do is something that's perhaps a little more, if you pardon the pun, a little more shocking. So we'll give a painful shock, we'll deliver a shock to, say, the base of the rat's tail, and I mean, we're not shocking the rat enough so that it's going to, you know, killing it, just give it a shock, and we're going to get a flinch. It's going to startle, it's going to move around on the platform. Let it calm down for a minute or so. Now go back and give this gentle touch on the back again. Now, we found before, the first time we did this, before we gave the shock, not much happened. Now, though, do the same sort of touch on the back, we get a flinch. This is sensitization. Okay, so something that previously did not produce a strong response, due to the occurrence of some other stimulus, we now get a greater response to other stimuli. Real world examples. Who likes like horror films, slasher films? A few people. Okay. Ever go to one of these with somebody that you know doesn't usually go to these films? It's fun. So right, we're watching the film, and if you're into this kind of film, it's like yeah, great. You know, oh, disembowelments. Yeah, lovely. Decapitations. Okay. But the person who's probably not very exposed is like. At this point, now here's the fun part. The next time something particularly tense, and you'll know when it's, I mean, if you go to these films, you know, like the music comes, it's all, you know, precursors to it, foreshadowing, right? Reach around them, tap them on the shoulder, right? Just as about someone's about to get chainsawed or whatnot. Popcorn's gonna go everywhere, drinks, scream. Okay, so that's a sensitization effect. They become sensitized. They're now, if you will, twitchier about things. This has a very strong survival benefit. Consider a, an antelope. All right? Here's a rustling in the grass. Now, it could just be the wind, could be some little rodent or whatnot, a giant poached rat of Gambia running past, could be a lion. Right? So, if you've got an antelope here that doesn't sensitize, they may be the ones that get picked off by the lion. Over evolutionary time, the ones that get eaten by the lion because they didn't develop a startle response when something novel occurs, they don't reproduce as often, so you get this sort of sensitization effect that evolves into the species, gets picked up. If you're a little bit twitchy, you might survive better. So these are issues of sensitization. Now, we can do a little bit of comparison here between them, looking at a few characteristics and traits. I just need to introduce a couple of terms here. We'll come back to them later in the course, but I'm going to just mention them here in the context of habituation and sensitization. These are generalization and discrimination. Generalization occurs when you treat another stimulus or other stimuli, more than one, like a stimulus that you've learned about. So if you learn to drive a car here in Edmonton, we use particular traffic lights. So, I don't know, the green glass in the traffic lights here in Edmonton are a particular shade of green. If you go to some other city where they're using a different manufacturer for traffic lights, it's probably a slightly different shade of green. If you still go when you see this slightly different shade of green, we'd say you've generalized. You've generalized from what you've learned here in Edmonton to some other context. If instead you just sit there and someone goes, why aren't you driving? The light's green. It's like, no, that's not the kind of green that I'm used to. It's like, dude, seriously, it's green. No. That's more of a forest green. Back home, we only go on more of a royal hunter green. My wife's a designer, so I know way more about the names for colors than any sane human ever should be exposed to. Okay, if you don't go off on this slightly different shade of green, we'd say you have discriminated, right? You're discriminating, right? You're telling the difference. Okay, so generalization, you treat other stimuli like something you've already learned about. In discrimination, you are going to be not responding to stimuli that are in some way, shape, or form different from those that you've already learned about. So you are discriminating. You distinguish between them. Okay, so let's just, and really they're flip sides. Okay, the more you are generalizing, the less you are discriminating, and vice versa. So with respect to habituation and sensitization here, in terms of generalization, we tend to see less generalization in habituation. Okay, they tend to be, in other words, habituation tends to be a more discriminatory process. So with our slug, we've been touching it, if we go back to the banana slug, we're touching it on the back, and this caused the eye stalks to eventually stop withdrawing. Now, if I'd been doing this with my finger initially, and then I tried this with maybe like a blade of grass or a twig, and again lightly touched on the back, it's probably still going to treat that as a similar stimulus. In other words, it will keep its eye stalks out. On the other hand, if I were to like drip some water from a canteen on it, or take apart a little transistor radio, shock it on the tail, eye stalks are probably going to come back out. They're going to come in. Okay, so it will not be habituated to these other stimuli. It won't treat them all as the same. And that makes good sense from a survival point of view. If you've habituated to something lightly touching you on the back, but then something, you know, is dripping on you, well, maybe that's a crow salivating, drip, a little bit of drool falling on you, and then there's a slug, maybe you better do something dramatic, pull your eyes in. In sensitization, though, we see quite a bit of generalization. So if with our rat, we've now given it a little electric shock, and now it flinches when it's touched on the back, it might flinch more if we snap our fingers or if we drip some water on it or do any number of other things. So if sensitization... If what sensitization's probably survival benefit is showing, yeah, there's nothing dangerous in the area. Well, if there's one dangerous thing in the area, there might be lots of other things. So, you know, back to the antelope in the grass, if it hears the rustling of the grass, okay, that's a lion. So, oh, I'm going to only respond to more rustling, but what if our lion, hypothetical lion in the grass, steps on a twig and snaps the twig? Well, if the antelope goes, oh, that's not a problem, that's not the rustling of the grass, probably gets eaten by the lion. So sensitization, you tend to see more generalization here. Lots of different things. So back to the movie, right? You know, and chainsaw on film and all of that. Sensitized, the person's getting tenser and tenser, okay? And then you tap them on the shoulder. Well, clearly this is a different sense modality, right? The movie's coming in with visuals and auditory. You know, there's very few movie theaters that are actually tactile. There's a few that like now are vibrating the chair for extra money and stuff like that. But so we try to touch something, totally different sense modality, and yet boom, big startle response. Okay, so more generalization there. How long do the effects last? In habituation, they tend to last longer than in sensitization. How much longer? Well, okay, see, here's the thing. We've said that learning is an, quote-unquote, enduring change in behavior due to experience. Okay. How long does this last? Sensitization, maybe minutes, usually no more than minutes, maybe, you know, for a person, maybe no more than a half hour. The fairly short term. Well, that's not terribly enduring. It's like, yeah, we're also not creating new synaptic connections, right? This is just changes at the synapse that already exist. But I mean, it's not gone immediately. So there is some degree of enduring here. In habituation, depending on things, again, minutes, hours, in some cases days, if you've been exposed to the stimulus over and over and over again for a longer period of time, it will last longer. When I used to go visit my grandparents, I'd always get stuck down sleeping in the basement. This was back in Michigan. They had this clock that would, God awful thing, it would chime the hour and then it would chime the half hour sort of thing. You know, the first night, you know, you get there, you're exhausted sort of thing, like every hour, bong, 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 you know, wake up sort of thing. After a night or two of this, just sleep right through it. Right? I've habituated to it. I don't even notice this. Okay, and once that's done, it can last. Right? If I go off someplace else, visit my aunts or uncles for a while, then come back to my grandparents, even after being away for a couple of days, you know, still didn't really notice the clock. I bet most of you don't notice when the clock here in this room goes clunk, clunk, and shifts over for another minute. If I was really lucky, I would do it right now. But not so lucky. You've habituated to that. You experience these clocks in all most of the university classrooms, and you probably don't notice them very often when they do it. So habituation can be a bit longer. Looking at it this way as well, what we're dealing with in terms of sensitization is something that's very stressful, right? This is increasing, if you will, sort of your fight or flight response. It puts a lot of stress on the body. If you were constantly in a sensitized state, well, your heart would probably just explode. Well, probably not explode, but I mean, this is putting a lot more stress on your system. So it tends to wear off more rapidly. If the slug, if I'd come back a few hours later, the habituation probably would have been gone. Maybe even an hour later, maybe even a half hour. Okay. This isn't too crucial at our point here. In this class, whenever I'm talking about habituation, you may have encountered this in a different course. There's actually two types of habituation. There's what's called short-term habituation and long-term habituation. Short-term habituation, when people use the term habituation, like 95% of the time, they just mean short-term habituation. That's what we're dealing with, and heads up, this is all I'll be talking about in this course. Okay? We're only going to treat this as short-term, which means it wears off, as I said, minutes, hours, occasionally days. All right? So it's relatively short. Long-term habituation is a bit different. There's actually a different underlying neurological process, and it does become permanent. We are not going to worry about that here in this course, but if you've taken some physiology or some neuro or whatnot, you might have encountered this, and your prof there has talked about the differences between them. So, okay, just a heads up on that. Rate of relearning. Once we go through either a habituation or a sensitization process, then we go away for a while, okay, then we come back and we try it again, we'll find that the relearning is quicker. It takes fewer trials to get to the same level of habituation or sensitization. So if it took us, whatever it was with the banana slug, like 6 trials before it's like just doing me with its eye stalks, barely moving them, if I went away for a couple of hours, went down to the beach on the West Coast, hung out there for a while, came back, if I could have been able to find the same slug and tried this again, the habituation probably would have worn off, okay? But it wouldn't have taken 6 trials to get back to that hardly responding at all level. Maybe only 3 or 4. So there can be a more rapid reacquisition of this. And that applies to both habituation and sensitization. There's a term here, and this is a little bit unfortunate in that the term cuts across different types of learning and can mean slightly different things, but we've got spontaneous recovery. This occurs after habituation and sensitization has occurred. So basically, spontaneous recovery with respect to habituation and sensitization means that if you just let some time pass, the learning will wear off. Okay? So if you wait long enough and you go back and you apply the same stimulus again, it'll be almost, it'll be basically as if the whole sort of system has been reset to zero. Okay? This is due strictly to the passage of time. Now, again, remember, habituation and sensitization, they are learning because there's a change here occurring in the nervous system. There's a change in the reflexive response, but it's not due to the formation of new synaptic connections. So it's non-permanent. These are just changes at the level of the existing synapses. Okay. But it's very significant. I mean, as you know, evolution processes of learning go, this is a big kind of step. You're not locked into. Organisms were no longer locked into just relying upon reflexive styles of behavior. These could be modified through experience. So, to kind of wrap up this first chapter here, we've talked a little bit about issues of natural selection in the context of adaptation to changing environments. Just sort of as a review here, one of the downsides of trying to rely on evolution to deal with changes in the environment is it's stunningly slow. Okay, it's a completely useless time scale for day-to-day processes. You will not evolve to be better at Psychology 281 over the next 6 weeks. If we took the people in this class that did really well in the final exam on this course, and then we mate them together, and we wait for their children to grow up and put them into this same course, and then make those children that do really well, we're probably doing something stunningly unethical. But leaving that aside, over maybe 15 generations or so, which would account for something like, you know, about 450 years, we could produce some students that would just be brilliant at Psychology 281, as taught now. Which may not be of any use at all 450 years in the future, as I suspect the field will have progressed. So they're going to be really great at early 21st century learning behavior theory, but probably suck at, you know, like 26th century learning behavior theory. So not terribly useful. Bit behind the time. And so, I mean, there's an evolutionary time lag to things. It takes a while for evolution to deal with things. If environments are changing very rapidly, there's going to be a lot of catch-up. Okay? Not catch up the condiment, okay, but having to catch up on things. So, okay, I mean, you know, I'm a bit roly-poly. We like sweet stuff. Yeah, a few people. Most humans do, okay? Sweets are great. They've got a massive, sugars have massive amounts of energy in them. These are wonderful things. Ancestrally, you know, pretty much the way that our ancestors were able to get a hold of these high caloric foods was by like fighting, you know, fighting a bunch of bees to get the honey, or there's a few sorts of vegetables that will do this, and fruit. And so when fruit would ripen, and we see this with monkeys, for example, just looking at some primates there, when fruit ripens, I mean, a local troop of monkeys go nuts and eat all the fruit they can, and just gorge on it. They'll even start eating the stuff that's fallen on the grounds, which then started fermenting. So then you get drunken monkeys, which of course leads to drunken monkey kung fu, which then of course leads to all the great drunken monkey kung fu movies that have come out over the years, which is a completely different course in film studies. But we can see that there would be an ancestral evolutionary pressure to consume things that had sugar, even if the sugars had fermented into alcohol, and we're making a little bit loopy as a monkey. So that carries over now, right? High caloric foods nowadays are really easy to get. You don't have to fight bees to get to the honey. right? You just go into Safeway and buy the honey or the candy bars or whatever. It is so readily available that ancestrally, our ancestors, if they could get any sorts of sugars, they ate it because there could be famine, there could be lean times, fruit wasn't around all year, so consume it. Nowadays, sugars are around all... I mean, look, we can get up here in Alberta, we can get a pineapple in December. I mean, how insane is that, right? I mean, that's crazy on some level. We didn't evolve to deal with this. So we eat sweet stuff all year because we've got this sort of predisposition towards it. There's a time lag, and of course, then obesity goes up, and coronary disease goes up, and all these other things. Okay, so there is a lag within this. Keep in mind as well, though, there's variation. Some people are not that excited by sweets. Some people have a preference for salts. Okay, so there is variation within this. And that's what the natural selection really works with. All right. So, what about learning then? Learning, in and of itself, as I said, you're not going to evolve to be able to learn the psychology 281 over the next 6 weeks. But learning, the ability to learn, that was selected for evolutionarily. Okay? You go, even the simplest of critters have basic abilities to learn. Slugs can habituate. Okay, that's a very basic type of learning. They can do this. Insects, worms, very, very simple. So pretty much all animals currently existing have at least a limited capacity to learn. And it seems likely the reason that that was selected for and has been passed on throughout all the animal phyla is because being able to learn confers a huge survival benefit, even if it's a very simple form of learning. You try something, it ends badly for you, assuming you survive, if you're less likely to do that again in the future, you're more likely to survive and reproduce and pass on those genes. Okay. So learning allows us to move then beyond these innate processes, beyond taxis and kinesis, beyond just our reflexes, okay? Beyond just these simple feedback systems and a control system theory. It allows for rapid adaptation to changes that occur over short time periods. Phew. Zinging this fast forward up to now, if you're thinking, so why is learning behavior course, why is learning behavior course actually significant? You know, if you're in a psychology degree or linguistics or whatever area you're in, well, that's because all people learn. All people will change their behavior due to experience. Whatever area you are interested ultimately in working in, this course has stuff that will be applicable. It will help you understand human behavior and, you know, potentially manipulate it to your advantage. Psychology is like the force, right? There's a light side and a dark side to it, okay? So we'll talk later about things like video lottery machines, okay? Yeah. Once you get through this course, you guys could probably set up the reinforcement criteria and stimuli just to make a kick-ass video lottery machine that would be stunningly addictive. That would be like heading off with the Sith, going to Vader's side of the Force. Or you could understand how it works and try to, you know, help people who become addicted to that sort of stuff. One pays a lot better than the other, incidentally. I'll leave you to figure that out yourself. But is what I mean. So that's applicable in daily situations. If you are in, you know, even if you're working retail, understanding how people make choices, how they adapt to sale prices, to all kinds of things, the environment in the store, these become relevant things. I was talking with one of the students last class about politics, how learning behavior studies are relevant in the area of politics. So, very applicable here. Now, if we go back, before there was a discipline called psychology, there was a field called philosophy. And there's been a long debate between philosophers, and because philosophy and physiology sort of merged together to make psychology, it's been carried over into psychology. And so one of the questions that has been around in psychology since its inception is, what's really more important, the nature of an individual or the nurture of an individual? Now, in today's terminology, by nature we mean your genetics, your genome. By nurture, we mean the environment that you're reared in, the environment that you experience. We'll encounter a guy called John Watson, and Watson thought it was what was really most important was the nurture. In other words, early in the 20th century, in the field of learning behavior, there was a very strong feeling that it was what you were exposed to that was most significant, that your genetics had relatively little significance in determining what you could learn, how you would learn, these sorts of things. There was two schools of thought on this one. There's what were called the British empiricists, and there was what were called the nativists. These are really philosophical schools of thought here. The British empiricist said that, ever heard the expression tabula rasa? So you're born tabula rasa, that is, it's Latin for blank slate. This goes back to when, you know, you'd go to school and you'd write stuff down on a little chunk of slate, like a blackboard chalk. That's how you take your notes. So the idea was, they said, well, when you're born, you are a blank slate, just waiting to have information and abilities poured into it through experience. Empiricism is experiencing the world, knowing by experiencing. So the British empiricist philosophical school said, they didn't use the term genetics, but they said your nature is unimportant. What you are is made by what you experience. The nativists, on the other hand, said, well, that doesn't sound quite right, because even newborns have stuff they can do. Newborns clearly don't learn, for example, how to nurse or how to clench the little fingers into hair and not let go, which makes it really difficult when you're walking around with a baby stuck on your head. I used to have longer hair. Don't anymore. I used to have hair. Don't anymore. So, anyways. I've adapted. I've learned to deal with that. Not necessarily well, but I have. So the nativist said, no, I think actually you got some abilities. Certainly you learn, but there's stuff you come with, too. As it turns out, over hundreds of years of this, and even within the last, say, 130-odd years of there being a field called psychology, what's happened is gradually there's been a realization that both are important. It's nature. It's not nature versus nurture. It's nature and nurture, or sometimes called nature via nurture. Genes and environment will continuously interact. If you really want to learn a lot more about this, take a course in behavioral genetics. Very, very cool stuff. Okay. So there's this ongoing interaction between them. Look at this. I mean, different genes activate at different points in your life. Oh, remember puberty? Remember how miserable that was? Yeah, okay, a whole bunch of genes suddenly have come online and started producing physiological, mental, hormonal, endocrine changes in you. Now, depending on the environment, for example, availability of food resources and fat stores in the body, puberty will either be earlier or later. Okay, so the environment, I mean, everyone's eventually going to, if they survive, go through puberty. But when that happens will be sooner or later, depending upon environmental characteristics. Okay, so there's a constant ongoing interaction here. So both our biology and our experiences will influence or shape critters, peoples, rats, dolphins, behavior patterns. Okay, so it's not one or the other. Even for you guys, this probably isn't a really big deal. You've probably more or less gone through school and it's like, yeah, it's both. Yeah, who could think otherwise? Even in the 1980s, when I started university, you still had people arguing that genetics had pretty much no role to play in a person's behavior patterns. It was all about the rearing. In fact, we actually do see this still now. Anyone think of recently in the press, an area where this comes up? Anyone following what's been happening down in the States, big presidential election promise? well, not really a promise for the election, but say, yeah, Obama's come out and says he's in favor of gay marriage, okay? Now, this goes back to, so linking into the whole issue of homosexuality, is homosexuality something that's just learned? Can you train it out of somebody? And in fact, California is moving to ban, not allow, various, we'll call them politely, conditioning techniques that are designed to try to cure homosexuals of being homosexual. American Psychological Association has disavowed these for the last, 25 years. This isn't work in the psychological process because there's a combination of things. Both genetics and environment come in. You're not going to be able to completely overwrite someone's genetic predispositions through conditioning. You can influence them, sure, but you've got to recognize that there are both. So, we don't see this in most things, right? But we still occasionally pops up. So, you know, keep an eye open for that. So, the ability to learn, and the ability to learn particular things, is going to be due to a combination of both your heredity and your experience. Some people really are better at math than English. Some people, other things. Some of you just have, for whatever reason, a better genetic predisposition to do this course. You can compensate if you do not have a genetic predisposition towards, you know, psychology. You can compensate to a degree by additional, you know, experience, studying, whatnot. I do not have, for example, a good genetic predisposition towards gymnastics. I bounce really well, so I could be like the ball in gymnastics. But, you know, if ever I was got stuck into some sort of ring competition, yes, Dr. Snyder has stepped up to the rings. Yes, he's doing the iron nail. I can't do anything else. I think my shoulder has just come undone. Oh, yeah. Okay. So it's a combination. I could maybe get a lot of training and eventually do something with rings, like swing a little bit. All right, so there's a combination of your heritability, your genetics, and your experience. A variety of studies have demonstrated this quite nicely. So we can take, for example, rats, and we can change the kind of environment they're reared in. We can have rats that are genetically very similar. We can have inbred strains of rats. So in other words, they're essentially clones. And we can take half of them and raise them in. You know, all their basic needs are met. They get their food, they get their water, they've got some little wood chips on the in their cage to lie on, poop on, do all of that. Everything's lovely for them, okay? And then we can test them on some mazes or something like that. We can take the other half of the rats and put in rat toys for them. These could be complex, sort of like habit trails. It could be a little wooden ball. One of the things rats love is PVC tubing. We'll give them about a three-inch diameter chunk of PVC tubing. They'll run through it. They'll try to, like, barrel roll, balance on it, like, walk on it. If there's multiple rats in the same cage, it's like they get stuck in them and run around. So, okay, we take those rats and we run them through the same mazes. And we'll generally find that they do better at the mazes. So a change in the environment, genetically, our two groups of rats here are pretty much the same. As I said, we can do a technique that's called inbred strains, so they're essentially clones. We give them different environmental experiences, and the behavior is different. So this does suggest that early childhood experiences do play a role. So Alfred Binet, generally credited with being the founder of modern IQ testing, intelligence testing. Do you know what he originally set up his intelligence testing to achieve? What the purpose was? Right, for French public education. Binet's approach wasn't to segregate. He said by using his intelligence testing, we can identify the children that are having problems in particular areas, give them additional help to bring everybody up to a high level. Somewhat tragically, over about 100 years, this has turned into a segregatory process. So now people get streamed based on various types of intelligence testing. Well, you have to go into the dumb math class street sort of thing. Okay. So what Bidet realized early on was that regardless of what some initial level of ability was, environment could, to a greater or lesser degree, influence this. Because that's what he set up his initial testing for, was to try and bring everyone up to as high a level as they possibly could. So this takes us into things like educational aids for infants, like the Baby Einstein stuff made by Disney. The idea being, or Playmates Mozart for children. They'll obviously do better at mathematics. Really? Why? Because that's a slightly unsatisfying answer. the Baby Einsteins is Disney's idea. If we expose children to, like, moving things and music and bright imagery and a whole bunch of toys, they'll actually, they sit rapt attention staring at the television screen. They must be learning. Yes, they're learning how to sit with rapt attention staring at a television screen. Matter of fact, Disney lost a lawsuit, I think about 3 years ago now, on this. They were sued over the claims that Baby Einstein would boost children's, for lack of a better word, intelligence. And ultimately, they have no evidence that this actually occurs. And so they lost the lawsuit, had to refund anyone that won. Well, it didn't apply to Canada, but anyone in the States who bought Baby Einstein videos could send them back and get a complete refund. They were forced to repay because they were essentially engaging in false advertising. They had no evidence. It's like, but look, the kids look at the screen. Yes, the kids look at the screen because they're tapping into some genetic predispositions in terms of tracking bright, shiny objects. We do this. Ever noticed how if you're sitting in a room or a bar or a doctor's office and there's a television going in the corner, you almost feel compelled to look? Whoa, something moved. You look. That's a fairly innate response. If something moves off on the periphery of your vision, something's moving quickly anywhere, either it's something that you could be chasing down, possibly to eat, or it's something that's going to chase you down to eat you. You should pay attention to it. Those of our ancestors that didn't pay attention probably either missed out on food or got eaten. Bad luck. Yeah?
Because there are so many different ways of learning,
yes.
Why is it that modern education focuses on, mainly focuses on the literary and mathematical?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Why does modern education focus so much on these particular ways of doing language arts and English and social? Largely because they're trying to make the best of a bad situation, I think. This is my opinion on this one. Here, you probably have to actually talk to an education theorist to get their take on it. But they're dealing with large numbers of students that they have to deal with all at once. There's a limited number of teachers and resources for. I mean, ideally, I would have a class like this of no more than about 6 students, and we'd just sit and talk about stuff. And then someone would ask a question, and I'd say, like, that's an excellent question. Okay, for next week, come back with a way of actually studying that, and we'll try that out. That'd be a great course. I mean, it would necessitate that less than the, let's see, how many people apply for 281 every year? About 1,000. So we'd need more like about 18. So they're kind of stuck, and they drop into these patterns of what people think are going to be significant. Economics plays a role in this as well. I mean, you know, it's tough to get a job if you can't read well or convey information well, hence the language arts. That applies even to university. I mean, one of the things the psychology department here did a survey a number of years back and found, what are our graduates actually doing? Turns out that remarkably few of them are actually doing something that specifically required, like, you know, a behavior course or a cognition course or whatnot. What employers really wanted was students to be able to think and articulate. So to be able to evaluate concepts and communicate them. Is there anything else we can train them to do in 6 months? But that's what we really need. So there's maybe a bit of focus on that. For the mathematics, again, hard to say exactly why. I mean, you know, math isn't unimportant. Why the significance? Historically, it's been done that way. I mean, you got to remember, historically, education was, in terms of these sort of subject disciplines, was a highly elitist sort of thing. the vast majority of people did not go on to learn mathematics beyond sort of haggling over the price of a duck in a market. But in terms of a formalized school system, even going back to the Greeks, you were dealing with an elite group of students from basically wealthy families, and this kind of stuff set them apart. So it's a fascinating question. But more broadly, an additional question of this is the sort of way of having people sitting in rows in classes when you're 6 years old or 7 years old, is this really the best way for you to learn anything at all? And for some students, it is. Right? There's differences in heredity. Some students do great with this. Many do not. And there probably are better ways to do this. Small groups, small one-on-one, social learning situations. But again, due to the resources available, we need a lot more teachers, and we need then a lot more funding for teachers to actually be able to implement some of these. Okay, so let us move on here. And here we go, chapter 2. Chapter 2 is going to take us into a discussion of some of the methods and techniques for actually studying learning and behavior. And really the place to begin is talking a little bit about science. The U of A is kind of odd here on so many levels, but specifically in terms of psychology and how we're split. I mean, this is a science option, right? How we're split between the arts and the sciences. The reason for that is historical. It goes back to when they founded the psych department in the 50s, and half the people came out of physiology and half came out of philosophy, and the physiologists didn't want to give up their grade promotion level for seniority based upon the science model of things, and the people in philosophy didn't want to have to start writing all kinds of articles as opposed to the occasional book to get promoted, and so, boom, we ended up in two different faculties. Some universities it's arts, others it's science, a few places, actually more than a few places, psychology is just seen as one of the liberal arts, which there's no distinction between arts and science. Regardless, pretty much everybody that does psychology today in a university setting, carries out research, utilizes the scientific method. So in that sense, research-based psychology, not the crap self-help stuff that you'll see in, you know, chapters, and you go, psychology, oh, this really isn't psychology, is it? No, it's not. But for anyone who's doing actual academic research-based psychology, they're using science. So the division between arts and science is kind of irrelevant here. When we look then at the scientific approach, one of the things you have to realize right from the get-go is that thinking about things scientifically is very odd. We are not predisposed to think about things in the way that way scientists do. We'll come back to this in a little bit. We'll come back to the concept of correlation and how correlation doesn't actually equate with causation. Some people sometimes say, you know, getting back to issues of what about children, some people say, oh, all children are scientists. No. All children are empiricists. All children will go out and learn about the world by trying things. That is not quite the same thing as science. Science utilizes empiricism and a bunch of other things, and it does it in a very formalized way. So I will agree with the statement that all children are empiricists, but they have to learn scientific method, right? So sticking the fork in the light socket, that is empiricism. It's science if you get a control group and an experimental group and you do it over and over and over again and record your data and draw conclusions based upon it. Six of my control group ended up with snaky fizzed hair and had to go to the hospital. Okay, so here's the thing. So what does science do? Science does some fairly specific things. So first off, it's a particular way of thinking about the natural physical world. Okay, science, when it gets into dealing with spirituality, You can apply scientific method to spirituality, but spirituality is really based on belief. And we can talk about perhaps why our brains are predisposed to utilize belief systems, but you're really not going to change anyone's belief system, or at least most people's belief system, based upon a scientific explanation. Rather different spheres of influence. Okay. What science does is science is a very formalized way of asking and answering questions. So you ask various questions, and then you do this process to get an answer. At the heart of this, science is based upon observation. So we observe what happens. Sometimes that's in experiments. Other times it's in things that are called case studies, or we utilize descriptive studies, these sorts of things. But at the core of this is observation. We go back, and people often talk about Aristotle. Oh, foundation of Western science goes back to Aristotle. Not really. Aristotle was much more of a philosopher. So Aristotle would come up with things like, well, if you drop two objects from the same height, the heavier one will drop faster than the lighter one. No, he's wrong. But it makes sense. Yeah, if you got something that's three times as heavy, it should fall three times as fast. Duh. It just doesn't. It doesn't work that way. Okay, so he wasn't really a scientist in that sense. He was more of a philosopher. Sometimes he dabbled in a little bit of observational method. People like Galen, surgeon in Rome for the Colosseum, was more of a scientist. When he's trying to put gladiators back together, he'd find out how things worked or didn't work. Being hit in the head repeatedly seems to make this gladiator a bit more wonky. I wonder if there's something going on there. Yeah, okay. What if I poke the brain here? Oh, his leg twitched. Yeah. Okay. So it's based on evidence. So science is based on evidence. Okay. What are the facts? Old TV show called Dragnet. Okay. Cop show. Joe Friday, the cop. And you know, the tagline for this, Joe Friday's line when being on a crime scene was just the facts. Right. So interviewing somebody is just the facts, ma'am, or just the facts, sir. That's essentially science. What are the facts? What's the evidence? All right. What are some of the basic assumptions here? Well, first off, you know, this one almost goes without saying, but we assume a true and physical universe actually exists. If you know, it's like that's you know one of the discussions you have when you're drinking. It's like, what if actually we're all just a dream, and the dreamer's actually somebody else's dream, and this bubble coming up in the beer is like a whole universe. Science just assumes that an actual true physical universe exists. We also assume that the universe is primarily an orderly system. This does not mean that, like, your apartment or your house is neat and tidy. What we mean by an orderly system is that if we have systems that work, all other things being equal, if we, you know, are around a sun of the same mass and we have planets of the same mass, we will expect similar, for example, gravitational processes to work. If the brain works based on neurotransmitter releases, whether it's the brain of a rat or the brain of a human, we will expect to see that the neurons will work in pretty much the same way. So there is an orderly system to things. Now, if you change some of those criteria variables, you may get a very different outcome. But assuming that we can see similarities, we will expect to get relatively similar outcomes from the systems. Third, the principles of our orderly universe can actually be discovered. Otherwise, why bother? So we assume that by doing scientific methodology, we can gradually get insight into how the universe really works. Finally, and this is the one that perhaps people have the most difficulty wrapping their noodle around, and that's that all knowledge is tentative. You may look like you've got the answer, but scientists have to recognize that new research techniques, new methodologies, new equipment will show up and cause you to reevaluate earlier ideas. So let's go back to Freud's psychoanalytic theory of the id, ego, superego. With subsequent development of MRIs, there's no particularly good evidence that there's specific parts of the brain that deal with this. Or we'll start talking next class about Pavlov and classical conditioning. Pavlov thought that the way that classical conditioning worked was by different parts of the brain actually sort of cross-communicating, and it was based on proximity. So if the dog salivates at the sound of a bell and then also salivates at the sound of a whistle but doesn't salivate for the for a red light, that's because the part of the brain that processes the red light is physically further away from the parts of the brain that deals with the sound. Now, keep in mind, to give Pavlov his credit, he's doing this in like 1890 when, you know, looking at the brain basically meant taking a cleaver and going, thunk, yep, it's pink and gray and squishy. Okay, so things got better. Based on this, we know Pavlov's idea here was wrong. I mean, his principles of classical conditioning aren't. Those apply, but his explanation for neurologically how it worked had to be revised. So that's what we mean by knowledge is tentative. So conclusions in science may always be altered, changed, reversed, completely overthrown based upon subsequent evidence. And that bothers some people because that is disconcerting, right? The idea that everything you thought you knew may not actually be true. It can be very disturbing. I get that. Scientists just sort of have to wrap their head around that and accept it. Okay. What about in the context of psychology? Well, psychologists accept that all behavior is actually caused. There is a reason why behaviors occur. Could be genetics, could be experience, could be the interaction between them, could be stimuli in the environment interacting with the genome and the experience that has occurred in an individual. But there is a causal reason for things. Causes precede effects. Something occurred that made this behavioral response occur. Okay. Oh, natural phenomena. I think that's supposed to be something got erased there. Only natural phenomena. So only in there. Sorry about that. Science says that, that things are based only upon the natural. Again, the physical. All right. The brain is a physical system. Neurons are physical systems. Neurotransmitters are physical molecules. So when looking for explanations as to how the behavior of an individual, why it occurs, how it occurs, goes back to something natural. There's nothing psychologists say, it's not metaphysics here. Ultimately, we can find the explanation in the physical universe, the world, and the brain. Maybe very complicated, maybe very difficult to figure out, but there should be something that's based on a natural system that is responsible. Last one here, and this is a good one to remember in actually all areas of science, not just psychology or behavioral sciences. It's the concept of parsimony. All other things being equal, the simplest explanation that fits the data is probably the best one. At least that's the starting point. Okay. So if you have to explain a behavior, or if you're going to study a behavior, start with the easiest approach to it. Why did the rat press the lever? And, you know, so you press a lever, you get a rat yummy. Why did the rat press the lever? I'm going to just hypothesize as a start here that the rat's figured out that if it presses the lever, it gets a rat yummy. Let's go with that. Let's try that first, as opposed to, oh, the rat's playing a cunning mind game with the researcher. He doesn't actually want to press the lever. He's just doing it to lure the researcher in. While the researcher is working on the PhD, then the rat will stop pressing the lever, destroying the person's life out of revenge for keeping him in a cage all these years. That is possible. Probably unlikely, but let's not rule that out. Let's call that possibility B. Let's go with A, which is the rat's figured out can get a rat yummy. So you might change that by, well, what happens if you don't give it a rat yummy when it presses the lever and see what happens? Or what happens if you change the rat yummy? What if you give it three rat yummies when it presses the lever instead of one? So you can manipulate the system and see what happens. So parsimony. Generally, the easiest explanation that can explain things is probably going to be the correct. Not always. Sometimes you end up with stuff that's like, huh, what do you know? The rat really is doing a cunning plan. Surprising.
Right.
So, how do we go about actually acquiring knowledge? There's actually a lot of ways to do this. Science is really just one of these. Tenacity. Tenacity is a method of gaining information about the world, and it's largely based on, because it's always been that way, right? Why does the sun set in the west? Because it always has. Okay, why does spring come after winter? Because that's the way it is. That's the way it's always been. For as long as anyone can remember, it's always been that way. Look, if you are a farmer and you have to plant some crops to keep your family alive, that might be as good. I mean, you probably don't. Oh, well, that has to do with the fact that the Earth is rotating on an axis going around a large glowing ball of gas we call the sun, and there are going to be different seasons depending on the tilt of the axis, and blah, 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 blah. That's probably not all that relevant to, I think I should plant my seeds in spring as opposed to winter. Okay, tenacity can be great, you know. Gives the kids, right? Dad, why is the sky blue? Ah, that actually has to do with particle diffraction. So there's very small particles. What's a particle? Particle's a little thing. Oh, okay. Like the cat? No, the cat's made up of multiple particles. Oh. So half a cat? Yes, you're getting closer to a particle of half a cat. Anyways, there's stuff in the atmosphere, and the sunlight comes through, and you get refraction patterns. And this, what's a refraction pattern? You've seen a rainbow? Yeah. So refraction patterns are rainbows? No. Well, yes. The sky is blue because it isn't orange. Okay. Ask me this again in 2 years. Okay. Yeah. Sometimes that's just good enough. When's Christmas going to be? A long time from now. Why? Because it is. Huh? Well, because of the Julian calendar and how we... Tenacity. It's a way of gaining information. Perfectly valid. Perfectly valid if it works for you. Oops, that's not what I wanted to do. Oh, it is. Intuition. Intuition. This is kind of like the aha moments. You just have a feeling that something's going to be correct or not. You might be right, you might be wrong. Okay? Now, intuition is caused by something, by experience, by your predispositions to detect things, what have you. But you can't really, usually with intuition, work your way through the cognitive process that's led to the conclusion. These are often described as the light bulb moment or the aha moment. And tragically, they are stunningly rare and won't, you know, you are unlikely to have that perfect intuition moment. I'm not going to study for the final in the course. I'm just going to rely on intuition. Yeah. That doesn't often work well for people. I don't advocate that approach. You occasionally get this. I've forgotten his name. The chap that came up with the molecular structure for the benzene ring, right? He said one night he was having trying to figure out benzene. It's a molecular ring for months or years, I'm not quite sure. But the story, apparently, as he told it, was that one night he was having a dream of a snake slithered along. Another snake slithered up behind it, bit its tail, another snake bit that snake's tail, and so on, until the first snake bit the tail of the last snake, and it all went rolling off in this awkward snake ring. And he, was it Faraday that did this? Oh, wow. See, that's the joy of having an internet connection here in class. So Faraday, all right. He woke up at night, and, out of his dream, and screamed, "Benzene!" And his wife rolled over and said, "Who's this benzene you're talking about?" No, that probably didn't happen. It's not like he just, was some gal walking down the street and suddenly said, "It's a ring." He'd been working on this for a long time. All right? So the intuition was due to all this other experience that he'd had. Okay. Sometimes it works out for people. I keep pressing the wrong button. All right. Authority. Authority, you get your knowledge because someone in authority has told you so. whether this is a religious leader, a political leader, a teacher, a parent, an older sibling, whatnot, if you take their advice because they are an authority, it's a way of gaining information. You're making some assumptions there. You're assuming that the person who's in the authority actually has the knowledge, and they're not just, you know, messing with you. This raises an interesting question. I mean, do you trust your politicians? I'll let you decide that yourselves. What kind of experience, what kind of training do you have to go through to become a political leader? Right? I mean, do prime ministers go to prime minister school? You have to take post-secondary education in running a country? What about an MLA? Yeah, I did a bachelor's in MLA school. Elect me. No, not usually, right? Remember? Oh, you're probably too young to remember Ronald Reagan. Okay. Actor, American president. Actor well known for such classic roles as Bedtime for Bozo, where he starred opposite a chimp, and the chimp got higher billing. And became president! Or, you know, the Terminator, the Governator, Arnold Schwarzenegger being governor of California. Because I'm sure, you know, starring in Predator gave him great experience to lead a state. Okay, regardless whether he's good or bad at it, you assume. On some level, you either assume or not that an authority figure has got the goods. I'm sort of an authority figure here in this class. I'm standing up here and you're all sitting comfortably down. Somehow I've got the feeling this should really be reversed. I should be seated and you guys should all be standing, you know, varicose veins and ruining your back and all that stuff. Regardless, you're kind of assuming that I have some sort of authority here, that I actually know what I'm talking about. I do, but I mean, you could go check and see whether or not I really have a PhD. You can go and check and see the department whether I've taught this before and whatnot, but authority, okay? So take the word of somebody else. And I'm having problems learning which button to push. Rationalism. Rationalism is, if you're taking philosophy, philosophy courses, this is basically what we mean by logic. So you're trying to work through the rules of logic to get the answer. One of the beautiful things about applying logic is you will always get a correct answer, given the starting axioms that you work with. I mean, the starts looks really great. Wait, you mean with logic I can always get the right answer? Yes, at least in the theoretical construct that you've set up when doing that little philosophy thought experiment. Okay, so I'm going to give you swans are large, white, aquatic birds. Okay? Those are my axiom, my premise. It's a bird, it's large, it's white, and it's aquatic. So all swans must be large, white, aquatic birds. Except for the black swans of Australia. Which are definitely swans, but they're not white, they're black. Oops. So if you say, you know, if you did this within the logic, it's like, well, I've got this black thing, it's a bird, it's black, it's large, and it's aquatic, that is not a swan. In the real world, it is a swan, but in the little logical thought process we're doing here, it's not. Okay? So logic is great as long as your starting assumptions are correct. You can always work your way through to a correct outcome. Anyone watch, you know, classic Star Trek, Mr. Spock, you know, logically, Captain, we don't stand a chance, that sort of thing. And McCoy is going, damn it, Spock, you know, can't just be a computer and do this stuff, blah, 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 blah. And Kirk goes, I don't know, the alien's fairly attractive. I think maybe she'd like to sleep with me. If not, we'll shoot it with phasers. Okay, look, all right, Spock's logic doesn't always work out because it runs into the messy realities of the real world. Here's an example of logic in action. Whoops. Right, so, you know, the classics of Monty Python, they're Middle Ages, exactly like that. Yeah. Okay, so, yes, logically, she weighs the same as a duck. Okay. Well, okay, within that thought experiment, yes. In reality, I don't think so. So, logic is a way of gaining information. Empiricism. Mentioned earlier, all children are probably empiricists, but that doesn't make them scientists. Empiricism is just knowledge by experience. So, direct experience. You try something, you find it out. This is probably an improvement on most of the other aspects here we've discussed. I could give you... I could give you an assignment. It's spring. Spring is in the air. Sparrows are building nests. I could say, okay, right. Go find out how sparrows are building nests. There's a lot of construction still going on here around campus, so you might find out, yep, sparrows make nests out of bits of concrete, structural steel, and some insulation they find. Are you sure? Oh, yeah. I watched the sparrows over by the parkade where they're doing building. That's what they made their nests out of. Empirically, you're correct, right? But probably not all sparrows do it that way. But the sparrows that you observe do. So from an empirical point of view, as an empiricist, you would be correct. In your experience, looking at the sparrows that you looked at, that you observed, that's what they made their nests out of. But you can't really claim... or you shouldn't at least claim, that all sparrows are going to build their nest that way. So, what do we got? We got what's called scientific empiricism, or sometimes just called science, okay, or the scientific method. So scientific empiricism. Scientific empiricism takes the basis of empiricism, which is, you know, observation, but it puts controls in place. It'll use multiple subjects. It will, sparrows, it will send people out to observe sparrows in lots of different locations. It may look at different species and compare across species. It may take sparrows in the lab, raise them in the lab, and give them access to various materials. So, scientific empiricism. Science, more broadly, uses all of these. I mean, tenacity, intuition, authority, rationalism, empiricism, and then the controls that we put in place through the scientific method. So actually all of these factor into science, okay? But there are some very specific things that are being done when you are following a scientific method. So what does a scientific research process actually necessitate or involve? Well, to begin with, actually you have to come up with a question. That's actually the easiest part. So coming up with things to study, that's not that hard. It then proceeds to get a bit trickier. And here's one of the essentially tricky parts is, how are you actually going to answer that question, you know, scientifically? What controls do you need? What subjects are you going to use? What do you have to do to try to minimize confounds? So how are you going to actually go about doing this? And that's where it gets a little bit harder. Then you move into actually the empirical observations, or we just call it data collection. So you're going to collect your evidence, you collect the facts, you run your study. And finally, data analysis. You got all this data, now you have to interpret it. And if you're doing good science, you actually interpret the data correctly. You don't say, oh, the data's telling me this, but I'd really rather it was this other thing, so I'm going to go with that. That's what we call bad science, or just lying. It happens occasionally, but generally not. Mistakes do happen, right? But that's why it's good to publish. Other people can go and test things and say, I found we can't actually replicate the results. It's like, oh, darn, I see what happened. I goofed. Yeah, okay, my mistake. It's like this. So that happens. Innocent mistakes do occur in data analysis. All right. Now, when looking at behavior from a scientific perspective, one of the problems that early researchers in the field faced was they quite often fell into circular explanations for things. And this was a difficulty through studies of behavior through the 19th century and even into the early 20th century as how to deal with these circular explanations for behavior. So, for example, an old classic question, why did the chicken cross the road? Answer, to get to the other side. Okay, seems straightforward enough. But what if we then say, well, how do we know the chicken wanted to get to the other side of the road? Well, answer. Obviously, because it crossed the road. Yes, but I'm still fuzzy on this. Why did it cross the road in the first place? I thought I told you to get to the other side. Yeah, I know, but how do you know it really wanted to be on the other? Well, because it crossed. Are you dumb? Are you not getting this? I think I am, but we seem to keep... Huh. So this becomes, you know, why did the rat press the lever? Because it wanted to get the food. I see. How do you know that? Because it got the food, right? And it pressed the lever. Yeah. Do you think there was something else additionally going on there? Oh, I don't know. So this is sort of a problem historically for the study of behavior. And this is probably why, in part, it took until really the late 19th century, actually into the early 20th century, for the field, the study of behavior, to really get going. There had to be some way to get out of the circular explanation trap. And the solution that early 20th century psychologists and biologists study behavior, we call them ethologists, finally hit upon was that they needed to focus on the physical events that elicit the behavior. So in other words, the causes of the behavior. Instead of speculating, well, you know, it wanted to get to the other side of the road for some reason, it said, okay, what's causing that? Is there a fox chasing the chicken? Is there a big pile of food on the other side of the road? Are there other chickens going, come on, Rusty, if you run across the road when traffic's coming, you're in the club. What's going on? So what are the, you know, what are the physical events that precede a behavior? And then the preceding may be, you know, over a long time period. So what experiences did the organism have that perhaps didn't elicit this behavior? One of the chaps that sort of really strenuously argued for this in the very early 20th century, about 1917 or so, was, this is a picture of him later in life, a guy called John B. Watson. We'll come back to John in a while. John's probably better known for, you may remember this from your intro course, I'm sure they talked about it, they always do, the Little Albert study. We'll come back to that. We'll look at that in a bit more detail. Watson had physics envy, I suppose you'd say, and he hated Freudians. He wanted psychology to be treated as a respected science, because it really wasn't up to this point. So, like, people coming up with strange ideas or random things that really couldn't be, you know, based on emotions and internal drives that no one could observe. So there was a school of psychology in the 19th century called the introspectionist school. And the introspectionists would, they were, I guess to their credit, trying to be rigorous, they'd train people to be introspectionists. So they wanted to understand how the brain would work by getting people to describe the thoughts and feelings they were having when presented with stimuli. So they went through a rigorous training process, train people to be data-collecting introspectionists. So they'd show, for example, three highly trained introspectionists a red circle. And they'd say, now, describe. And one of them would say, you know, I feel loss and anguish. I'm remembering my first romance. Another would say, huh, I'm hungry for an apple. Third would say, why isn't it blue? Watson said, that's not science. That's just random crap. He said, in Freud, right? I mean, Freud, it's like, oh, you got those id, ego, superego. Really, where? So they're somewhere. Prove it. It's like, I mean, if that's the case, shouldn't all people behave, you know, in a similar kind of way? It's like, well, not necessarily. So you don't have an orderly system that you can apply. It's more of an art than a science. Freud was an excellent sociologist. He was not really a great psychologist, which is why he was actually a psychiatrist, but we sort of think of him as psychology. Anyways, Watson said, you know what, we're never going to be taken seriously as a field until we get away from all this, I feel something. You need to act. He said, look, you know, Rutherford, who's, you know, firing electrons at gold leaves and having things, you know, atoms break apart, he doesn't ask the atom, so how do you feel after I shot you with an electron? I feel broken up. No, real science doesn't do that. Real science just uses the facts. Oh, okay, the gold leaf is sending off electrons in other directions as the atoms are presumably being hit. Okay. So how can we do that in psychology? He says, just use observable events. So you get home. Let's imagine, maybe you have a dog, maybe you don't. Let's imagine you've got a dog. Open the door, the dog is running up to you. It's barking, it's jumping, it's spinning around. It's jumping up and down. Now, what can we say about that? Most people might say, oh, the dog's happy to see its owner. Watson said, are you sure? Well, yeah, it's jumping up and down. It's run up when the door is open. It's barking. How do you know the dog's not barking? Because, well, the owner's coming in the front door. You know, a thief is going out the back door with the big screen TV. Maybe the dog's trying to say, dude, somebody broke in. Dude, they're stealing your stuff. Come quick. Was that Lassie? Is a thief stealing my giant screen TV? Down a well? Is it little Billy? Watson said, you can't know. What are the facts? So the facts are, the dog runs up to you, it barks, and it's jumping up and down. Any independent observers can look at that and agree upon it. So that's science. As soon as you start inferring or guessing at the reasons, that's where it gets iffy. Okay? Now, we do this in psychology. We do make interpretations about internal states all the time. But he said, really, to be taken seriously, we have to go back to these facts, these observable events. So, facts and inferences. Regardless of the field of the division of psychology you're in, whether it's learning behavior or cognitive or developmental or abnormal, whatnot, most facts that are observed, recorded, detected, talked about in psychology, most facts are behaviors. Okay? Say, like, neuropsych, you might get into other things like, you know, the neuron has 12 dendrites. Okay, well, that's a fact. It's not really a behavior. It's a physical structure. All right? But in most areas of psychology, when you're talking about facts, you're talking about behaviors. Now, we infer internal conditions from facts. Okay? So we make what we call inferences. Okay, let's see. Intelligence, despair, this. Okay. Three things here. Intelligence, despair, eye tracking. Just take like 2-3 minutes. Amongst yourselves, find the people around you. Which of these are facts? Talk. Discuss. Confer. And why? Maybe they're all facts, maybe none of them are facts. Which are inferences? You get this way, this like talking to people thing's supposed to work, right? No? You want to try? Okay, how are we doing here? So, what about intelligence? A fact or an inference? Yeah, it's an inference, right? I'd agree with that. Okay. Somebody's going, oh, why? Okay, so people have thought maybe it's a fact. Why do you think maybe it's a fact? Yeah.
I just thought it was a construct because.
Oh, construct. Okay. Yeah, that's okay. Yes. I'd agree with you there. Yes, you're right. Yeah, we make constructs from inferences. So, yeah, it's not a fact. A construct is not actually a fact. A construct is something we treat as though it's a fact because we're making an inference about it based upon other data. But it's technically a construct. It's not actually a fact. It's based upon inferences. Okay, so, yeah, intelligence. I mean, we measure intelligence with test. So I will give you a midterm, and based on that, I may correctly or incorrectly infer something about how bright you are. Remember I talked about the student that came in, broke his leg on the way into the exam? Based upon his exam performance, he was dumb as a sack of hammers. I mean, he scored less than chance on his final exam. Less than chance. Close your eyes, pick, and we would have done better than he did. He broke his leg, okay? So he had some other stuff going on. But if it was just based upon the score, oh, 16%. This guy's stupid. Or he's broken his leg and is in, having some other stuff go on. So the fact is his score is 16%. That's a fact. Your performance on Stanford-Binet standardized IQ test, that's a fact. What it means is something else. Early IQ testing being used at Ellis Island in the United States, early 20th century, would give immigrants from Eastern Europe who didn't either read or speak English, the tests in English. And they tended to do very poorly on it. The conclusion was that immigrants from Eastern Europe were morons. And there was a technical meaning to the word moron back then. The fact was they failed the test. The reason for it had nothing to do about how cognitively savvy they was. It was just they didn't actually understand the questions they were being asked. Okay, so intelligence, no. How about despair? What do you think about despair? Fact? Inference? Inference, yeah. Yeah, I'd say it's an inference as well. Again, how are we measuring despair? Well, we're measuring despair by things like behavior, facial expression, lack of involvement in social activities, decrease in personal care, personal hygiene, increases in sleep, poor eating habits, okay? Physiological measures, right? Brain states, long skin response, all kinds of things. Those are all facts. We put those facts together and we say, that's what we're going to call despair. So despair is a construct. We're making inferences based upon a series of facts that we have collected. And we say there's this thing that we're going to call despair. Right? And we treat it. Now, this is the thing. For the general lay public, this probably doesn't matter terribly much. Whether you treat despair as a real thing, a construct, an inference, a fact. But for people in psychology that are trying to study psychology or want to understand the human condition, it's okay to treat despair as a real thing, but you've got to remember it's a construct. So when you're measuring it, you've got to go back ultimately to the behavioral facts. Last one, eye tracking. So if I look this way and you all look the same direction, what's that? Is that a... Yeah, it's a fact. Yeah, it's a fact. That's something you can directly measure. Now, why you're eye tracking, that's a totally different question. Okay, but that's a fact. That's a behavior we can measure. It's a really easy behavior to measure as well. In fact, eye tracking is often used to try to get ideas about preferences in pre-vocal infants. It's really hard to ask little babies that don't talk yet questions about what do you like. Okay, so what this technique was developed in the, late 80s, mid to late 80s. You sit the kid down, prop the baby up, sometimes it tip over, so you pack some pillows around them, and you show them side by side, for example. You could do it with sounds or visuals, whatnot, but let's say it's pictures, side by side in front of them, project a picture up onto a screen, and you just see which they look at longer. They may turn their heads, if they're too young to not just control their eyes, but they may... He tipped over, get him up. Okay, right? So eye tracking. It's like, okay, for whatever reason. Now, we're inferring that they look at this picture over here more. We might be inferring that's preference. Maybe it's novelty. We have to do some controls for that, right? But we've got a measure. We've got a fact here. What that means becomes another issue. I mean, this becomes another thing, right? We ask, I mean, you're all vocal, you can all talk. So I can ask you a question on a questionnaire, right? Is stealing wrong? And you'll come up with a response, yes or no. That's the fact. Your answer is the fact. What I should actually infer about your state of morality, your belief systems, whether or not you're telling me the truth, whether or not you think you're just giving the answer you want, you know, I want to hear, that becomes a totally different issue. The only fact I've got is your response on that question. So we may be inferring that if the kid looks at one image longer than the other, that shows a preference. We might have to control for issues of novelty or size or contrast effects, all kinds of things. And in fact, actually, these were issues that were discovered in as this was being adopted in the 80s. Children have predispositions towards things like luminosity and concave versus convex imagery, all kinds of things. So you have to control for all of that. But once you control for that, you're at least getting probably something that's implying a preference. Okay, let's take 10 minutes. So come on back at 12 past 12.